choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
Can I be locked? Okay, I'm out.
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
When that baby light, there's no doubt about it.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Listen, tranquility base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man.
Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 156 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Apollo 7, the flight.
Your Godspeed, Apollo 7.
Thrust is okay.
Roger thrust.
Very early in the flight, the general pattern of go for Apollo 7 was established in a conversation between the spacecraft and mission control at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas.
Right on the old button.
Good.
Flight booster.
Yeah.
We appear we may be slightly marginal on rocks. We'll keep
okay,
it.
Okay, stand by.
Cut off. J2, cut off.
Beautiful.
Fido.
Flight Fido, we're go.
Go across the board.
TMC looks good, flight.
25553. H dot is minus 4 balls, 1.
Across the board.
We have you go for orbit. You're go for orbit.
The launch went smoothly, the Saturn rocket blasting the command and service module into a low Earth orbit. To television viewers, as the engines ignited, there appeared to be one heart-stopping moment of hesitation. But, because Apollo and its two-stage launch rocket weighed 1.3 million pounds, the launch acceleration was gradual, taking 10 seconds to clear the tower. In mission control at Houston, the late morning liftoff dictated the orbital shift schedule. Lunny's team, with all the crewmen generally awake, worked the day shift. Krantz, the swing shift, with Don Isley on watch in the spacecraft, and Griffin got the graveyard shift, staying in touch with Wally Schirall and Walt Cunningham. Schirall had set up a duty watch on board the command module so that an astronaut would be awake throughout the entire mission. This plan was counter to the experience NASA had in Gemini, and no one of the flight directors thought Wally's watch was a good idea. It was tough enough to sleep the first days in space, and if someone is awake, rustling around, or communicating, it's almost impossible.
Slightly over 10 minutes after liftoff, Apollo 7's booster cuts off and orbit. The spacecraft stays attached to the S-4B second stage for a couple of revolutions while the crew tests out some procedures necessary on a later flight to the moon. 2 hours and 55 minutes after liftoff, they separate from the S-4B. Now they rehearse the turnaround and maneuver in which they would pick up their lunar module, or LEM, on a moon landing mission.
Following orbital injection and separation from the S-4B, the crew turned the command and service module around using its reaction control system thrusters, and Isley practiced a simulated lunar module rendezvous and docking using a visual reference target mounted inside the spacecraft adapter in the same radial position it occupied on the lunar module. One of the adapter panels on the S-4B failed to completely deploy to its 45-degree open position, reminding Capcom, who was Tom Stafford in this case, of his angry alligator experience on Gemini 9A, when docking was prevented by misdeployed adapter panels. Had this been an actual lunar mission, the astronauts might have found the process of lunar module extraction from the adapter more difficult, risking possible damage. This reinforced the decision to add a system to explosively separate and jettison the panels on all subsequent Apollo Saturn V flights.
Next, the spacecraft and S-4B stage were separated. The question now was whether the astronauts could turn their spacecraft around and control it to the degree required for future physical link-ups with equipment in space. For this, too, would have to be done in the lunar flight. And again, the answer was yes.
Those little flights are like Gemini?
Something that will not be seen in the lunar flight or in any other forthcoming Apollo mission were the panels at the top of the S-4B stage. They will simply be jettisoned in the future, but they drew comment in Apollo 7.
And the slot panel at the top, left, and bottom are opened, and I would judge to be about a 45-degree angle, and the slot panel on the right is just opened, oh, maybe 30 degrees at the very best.
Roger. Looks like you're looking at a four-jawed angry alligator.
Apollo 7 escorted its spent S-4B stage through space for perhaps 30 minutes, then departed.
That's a bigger one, Tom.
Rated now?
Yes.
It's absolutely beautiful here.
Now here's a clip of the astronauts describing the maneuver after the flight was over.
Well, what would you describe this? You were the photographer here.
These are the pictures that we took after the S-4B separation and turnaround. And while he's flying the spacecraft back in very gently, ever so gently, I should say, and we started taking films from, it must have been about 100 feet away and bringing it right on in. I believe the closest pictures we got were something like about 25 feet. We're looking at one of the deployed panels on the SLA, and I believe the one that doesn't quite show up down the lower right-hand corner is the one that apparently came open and then bounced back part way to about 20 degrees opening. Right now we're passing across the, we hit the States yet here, Wally?
Yes, we're just coming up on the Gulf Coast.
At the end of the first shift, Glenn Lunny handed Krantz a clean spacecraft at the beginning of the sixth orbit. The command service module was trouble-free, so Krantz's principal concern was a report by the weatherman that a low-pressure system was developing off Cuba, 750 miles south and east of Houston. With Houston's proximity to the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico, a hurricane could make it tough on mission control. About 15 hours into the flight, and a half hour before Krantz was to hand over the controls to Griffin's team, Sherall said, quote, "Houston, I have developed a head cold and have taken 2 aspirin. I've gone through 8 or 9 Kleenexes with some pretty good blows. I'm thinking about taking a decongestant or antibiotic," end quote. Krantz's team surgeon recommended the decongestant only, and Krantz took his surgeon with him to the press conference at 2 a.m. and was surprised by the large turnout. The doctor turned out to be the star of the show, and with few problems on the spacecraft, Sherall's cold, the first space illness, made the headlines of newspapers across the country and grabbed time on the network telecast. Cunningham and Isley soon caught Sherall's cold. Now, a cold is uncomfortable enough on the ground. In weightless space, it presents a different problem. Mucus accumulates, filling the nasal passages, and does not drain from the head. The only relief is to blow hard, which is painful to the eardrums. So the crewmen of Apollo 7 whirled through space suffering from stopped-up ears and noses. They took aspirin and decongestant tablets and discussed their symptoms with the doctors. Some of the crew's grumpiness during the mission could be attributed to this physical discomfort. Now, returning to the mission objectives. At liftoff, 3 flight tests remained before Apollo would go for the lunar landing. There was a lot to get done. The flight control team tracked each objective and added new ones to exploit each opportunity. With a single shot to qualify a spacecraft, little was left to chance. The Apollo 7 flight plan was incredibly precise, breaking objectives down and literally keeping each minute and second chocked full of activity. The flight plan was designed to cover all of these objectives, and if some weren't accomplished, they would be added to the workload of the next flight. As the flight progressed, the test results received led NASA to update the flight objectives, add new tests, or modify existing ones. It always has been this way in spaceflight, and it will continue to be as long as missions are measured in days and weeks. Chiral knew the lunar game plan and understood that there was a lot to get done before they could take the next spacecraft to the moon. According to Gene Kranz, as the mission continued, Wally's cold was as much a test of the flight control team as was flying the mission. The flight directors were hard-pressed to satisfy a cranky Chiral and push ahead to clear the deck for the next mission. There was little that pleased Chiral about what was going on at Mission Control, and the discomfort and irritability caused by his cold soon made him pretty testy with Cunningham and Isley as well. Glenn Lunny, in particular, always seemed to be at the helm when Wally was testy with the ground team. Tension with Chiral actually began with the launch decision, when flight managers decided to launch with a less than ideal abort option for the early part of the ascent. Once in orbit, the spacious cabin may have induced some crew motion sickness, which had not been an issue in the earlier, smaller spacecraft. So, as Chiral's head cold worsened, he became irritable with requests from Mission Control, and all three astronauts began talking back to the Capcom. An early example was this exchange after Mission Control requested that a TV camera be turned on in the spacecraft. Chiral, you have added two burns to this flight schedule, and you've added a urine water dump, and we have a new vehicle up here, and I can tell you at this point, TV will be delayed without any further discussion until after the rendezvous. Capcom, which was Jack Swigert. Roger, copy. Chiral, Roger. At this point, Deke Slayton decided to get on the line with Apollo 7. Capcom 1, Deke Slayton. Apollo 7, this is Capcom number 1. Chiral, Roger. Capcom 1, all we agreed to do is flip the switch. Chiral, the first part is garbled. Then he says, with two commanders, Apollo 7. But Slayton cut him off. Slayton said, all we have agreed to do this particular pass is to flip the switch on. No other activity is associated with TV. I think we're still obligated to do that. Chiral, we do not have the equipment out. We have not had an opportunity to follow setting. We have not eaten at this point. At this point, I have a cold. I refuse to foul up our timelines this way. Moving on from that exchange, the next significant event was the service module propulsion engine firing test. This engine had to fire right every time. It was the engine that would slow Apollo into lunar orbit and push Apollo back out of lunar orbit on the return trip. It was the only rocket they had for these crucial jobs. If it didn't work, the crew could not return home from the moon. Wally fired it up and moved into an orbit that would let him rendezvous back with the S-4B the next day. On the first firing, the crew had a little surprise. In contrast to the smooth liftoff of the Saturn, the blast from the service module engine jolted the astronauts, causing Sherrall to yell, "Yabba dabba doo!" like Fred Flintstone in the contemporary video cartoon. Later, Isley said, quote, "We didn't quite know what to expect, but we got more than we expected," end quote. He added more graphically that it was a real boot in the rear that just plastered them into their seats. But the engine did what it was supposed to do each time it fired. In fact, the service module engine performance was a joy. All told, the service module engine made 8 firings, performing within 1% of the engine acceptance test thrust and specific impulse values. After it worked the first time, Mission Control relaxed a little. The next major event was the return to the S-4B for a second rendezvous.
The following day, Apollo 7 burned its spacecraft propulsion system for the first 2 times in the mission and returned to its 4-jawed alligator, which was now angrier than ever.
And Apollo 7, Houston, how close are you now?
We're close to about 70 feet. It's tumbling rather wildly, so we should stay away from it.
Roger, understand.
Bring your copy, Jack, go.
Okay,
in this maneuver, Apollo 7 had accomplished the first rendezvous of the program, and in so doing had proven capable of meeting still another requirement for lunar flight.
1618+1221.
This is how the crew described the second rendezvous after the flight was over.
Well, this particular shot, I think we're about 25 feet away. Now, after a rather great amount of work that was done to accomplish this rendezvous, Don Isley got us in the position where I could decelerate and come back and see the booster again. This is the S-4B as we see it after the rendezvous was completed.
This is the documentary proof that we actually saw the S-4B twice. You'll notice that the slot panels are all deployed, and it's rotating at a fairly healthy clip. And it didn't seem to be having any special orientation. It was rotating about all 3 axes.
With the second rendezvous now complete, how about a little TV coverage?
Always before, we've had to be content with merely listening to our astronauts during their flights. In Apollo 7, through the medium of television, we could actually see them in space for the first time and become better acquainted with weightless life aboard a spacecraft.
You're picking up. I can read it now. Just a minute. It says, from that lovely Apollo something. You guys should write.
Apollo room. High atop everything. High atop everything.
Looks good. I can see Wally Hamlin now. Don has a smile on his face, and there's Walt. Okay, what's the next one? A little closer, Wally. It says, keep those cards coming.
Cards and letters coming in.
Coming in, folks. It's loud and clear.
Roger. Good morning to everyone in television land. You're looking at the right-hand portion of the main display console. In the upper left-hand portion of your view, you would see the instruments that have to do with the cryogenics that are used to power the fuel cells and provide breathing oxygen to the spacecraft.
Now I have a clip of the astronauts explaining the film they shot while in orbit.
We'd like to tell you about our flight the easy way. The first thing I'd like to do is to project some of the film that was taken with the spacecraft camera. We had a 16-millimeter camera on board. One of our first concerns was that we had had problems with other crews in extravehicular activity, or EVA. In this case, we were within a large spacecraft where we could move, and we were concerned somewhat about IVA, or intravehicular activity. As a result, we carried extra film with us, and it was quite surprising. IVA was a delight. It was very pleasant. and a very easy environment for man to live in, to adapt to immediately.
Okay, we're coming up along the Gulf Coast of the United States along through here. We took some very interesting stills of the S-4B above each of the major Gulf cities. You're looking down along the Gulf Coast there on the left, and we'll have, there's Apalachicola, I believe. It trails right on across Florida, and we had a very beautiful sight that we all were amazed at, looking down at the S-4B, backgrounded by the Cape. And here comes the Cape right over the top. There's where it all began, right there.
It's quite surprising, but each of us that come back say this must be a blue planet because of the bright blues of the ocean and the slight blue haze. This is Don's little rat nest where he kept his food compartment.
I found a little crack above the optic stowage panel. There you see where we had our toothbrushes and toothpaste and also our communications helmets when we weren't using them. There's Wally's stowage bag with a red towel sticking out of it. And there's mine with a helmet mounted below it. These were things were just pinned to the wall with snaps.
We're doing a little sightseeing here, and this is an example of how easy it is to move around in zero G. You'll notice we're moving very slowly. It turns out that you can adjust quite readily to the environment, and for several days up there, we were all commenting on how amazed we were that anybody could ever feel bad in the environment. It's just the most relaxing sensation you've ever had.
The interesting thing to note as we started the sequence, you must have observed there was no one there. As we continue the sequence, you'll note that Walt is lying down there, Don is getting dressed and attaching his communications harness, and that I'm over in this lower corner. And after we got back and saw this film, we began to realize that someone else must have been holding the camera.
It seems the television films, that caused some consternation, too, and there was no one in the couches. There seems to be a tendency of the ground, I think, to believe that unless somebody is sitting there, you know, really flying all the time, it's not going to stay up, but it's obviously not the case.
Don is at the lower equipment bay, as he is typically shown in these films, eating something, working at the sextant for an alignment. And rather interestingly enough, we had attachment points, a Velcro, which is a sticky material at the base of the spacecraft, to hold us in position. You'll notice Don isn't even using it. He is held in position basically by minor soft handholds.
Here's a good example. Don's sitting here, he's fixing a meal and is unpacking it right now, and he wants to leave something temporarily in the air. That's where he leaves it.
Well, it's also interesting, though, that I'm sitting sideways 90 degrees to what you'd normally think of being the normal way, but that doesn't seem to worry you up there. There isn't really any up or down. No one seems to care whether you're upside down or not.
Turns out you really need very little in the way of attachments or places to hold you. Here's Wally doing a demonstration of zero-G maneuverability. And you ought to see him come back. He's just as graceful as you ever saw anybody.
Gazelle boy Shirai.
This is very out of character for me, so they're giving me a hard time.
This next scene is not out of character for Wally, though. Here we go.
Well, Walt is the gymnast of the group, and he had to have his opportunity. The important thing is, you may note that we're having fun and games. The antics really are to demonstrate that we were very comfortable and did not feel that we were in an awkward environment. Notice the tremendous number of switches and circuit breakers we have, over 700. Not one was inadvertently actuated throughout the whole flight.
Walt's preparing some orange juice here. There's a water gun he used to put the water in the bag. He's in the process now of mixing it up. Well, this was to illustrate what gas bubbles do when you spin something. They don't actually coalesce into one large bubble, but they do concentrate in the center of the bag due to centrifugal force.
By spinning it up, we found that the little small gas bubbles would coalesce in the center.
Here I'm showing a plastic bag of coffee. This was our great high point after the rendezvous, to have a plastic bag of coffee. Notice the bubbles as they move. And this is quite interesting to us. We've had all sorts of experiments to determine how bubbles react in the weightless environment. And we'll spin this particular bag as well, and you'll see the bubbles concentrating right in the geometric center. this particular shot is a shot of the number one window, as I described it on my side, where some of the external debris from water dumps and urine dumps have collected on the outer pane. The demonstration we're trying to show to you here is that even as clear as these windows are, external objects that are with us in Earth orbit may collect on the spacecraft. From every flight, we've had reports of objects that seem to come off the exterior of the spacecraft, and this is what we've seen, finally, on the window itself. Walt, I think you should describe this one. You were nearer to it.
This is the picture, one of the very best we took, of Hurricane Gladys that was sitting in the Gulf of Mexico during the flight, and it, I guess it was the pass before this, or I guess maybe the day before, that Wally gave a mark over the hurricane itself, and we became a weather satellite. And this pass was just an exceptional one to be able to get a picture of the entire hurricane.
Now, as we are world travelers, I thought we might take you around the world a little bit. And here you can see the complete tracing of the Suez Canal, all the way up to Port Said, the Gaza Strip, and Israel, and the Republic of Egypt. I think it's rather interesting to note, particularly in our president's remarks and the work he has done to make our space program peaceful, that with the opportunities we had to fly between the latitudes of 31 north and 31 south, the world was very peaceful and very attractive to us. And I think we can show you that with some of these other slides. Here we are over the Ganges River of India and the Himalayas that were there a long time before Gordon Cooper went over. But Gordon Cooper is the one that had pictures of Himalayas from every different aspect, both on his Mercury and Gemini flights. And Mount Everest is up in this area, and the next one I think will show you the fantastic elevations of the Himalayas.
It's one of the dominant scenes for the first several days of the flight, is you always seem to have good daylight right over the Himalayas. And the picture you have right here, for example, there's the 12 tallest peaks in the world are all in that picture.
And here is a picture of the Tibetan area. You notice the snow line, that's about 18,000 feet. And the clarity of this is due to the fact that there's very little atmosphere from this surface up to where we are. And where our spacecraft started is shown in this slide. We are off the west coast, and you can find that we have the California area right there. Los Angeles, Palm Springs, Lake Tahoe, Las Vegas. And you can see just a little bit of the smog that seemed to permeate the air over the Los Angeles area. And fortunately, we didn't have to take any of that with us in the spacecraft. Here we have Mobile Bay, Mobile itself, Brooklyn Air Force Base. Another generator of smoke is Birmingham. I would like to make note of the fact that from this you can see smoke in various areas coming through, and it shows what man can do to a beautiful climate by polluting the atmosphere. This is our classic victory at sea picture of Florida. I think, Walt, you might describe how this one was taken.
It shows there's no substitute for experience. We were we just departed the Houston area, running across the Gulf Coast, and it was kind of dim light. It was towards the end, and we were running out of film, and I was being kind of tight with it. And Wally says, "Hey, there's a good picture. Take it." And I says, "Oh, the light's no good." He says, "Shoot it." He says, "They really go for that sunshine coming off the water." All I can say is he was 100% right. Next time I saw it was on the front page of Florida paper.
The live TV video reports, which lasted 7 to 11 minutes each day, had caught the public's fancy. They were dubbed the Wally, Walt, and Don Show, and they aired once every morning during the Apollo pass between Corpus Christi, Texas, and Cape Kennedy, the only two ground stations equipped to pick up the transmission. By the third day, Sherall canceled the daily TV broadcast with a clipped, "No further discussion." Mission Control was left with the task of convincing a skeptical press that all was well between the operations team and the crew. Deke Slayton, embarrassed by Sherall's outburst regarding the telecast, murmured on the voice comm, "Wally, all you gotta do is flip a switch." By the fifth day, the headlines in the Houston Chronicle declared, quote, "Captain awakes grumpy," end quote. The press started getting in their licks, and the controllers counted the days until they could get a new crew. None of the mission rules discussed dealing with a grumpy commander. Chiral finally relented on the broadcast, and at one point, the astronauts, trying to make amends, held up crudely lettered signs that read, "Hello from the lovely Apollo room, high atop everything." Salutations from a campground near Houston, Texas. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 156 of the Space Rocket History Podcast entitled Apollo 7, The Flight, Part 1. Space Rocket History is a proud member of the History Podcasters and the Tech Podcasting Network. I want to give a big shout out to all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed and extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. I'm glad you're here. Today we salute my Patreon donors. Patreon donors donate a small amount monthly. Thanks to all my Patreon donors that honored your monthly pledge. As expected, I have a few afterthoughts. Well, obviously, having a cold in space is no fun. I would probably be pretty grouchy as well. With all the work that had to get done and the mission control, then mission control adds more stuff, and also, you have to be on TV. So it was kind of rough on the guys up there in Apollo 7. But with all that said, I think Wally crossed the line just a little bit when he refused to flip the switch for the TV camera. Don't get me wrong, Wally was a superb astronaut and an all-around great guy. But all the grouchiness and complaining was just a distraction. The mission was going very well. The service module was firing correctly. They were able to maneuver for a rendezvous and come back for a second rendezvous with the S-4B. The capsule was working well. And even though the astronauts were grouchy, they were doing a very good job. So far, Apollo 7 has been highly successful. And that's the part I really want to stress in the grand scheme of things. The grouchiness, that doesn't really matter. But the performance of the vehicle and the crew does, and both were doing a very good job. And remember, they were trying to prove that capsule and service module in one flight, because the next one, they want to make a circumlunar flight. So this is one flight to prove everything. Okay, moving on. I posted some photos from this week's episode at the website, spacerockethistory.com. Check that out if you get a chance. Donations. I was pleased to receive a couple donations to support the podcast this week. Peter C. from Australia donated at the Mercury level. And Flosen pledged on Patreon at the Vostok level, which brings our total number of Patreons to 46. We only need 4 more Patreons to reach the goal. It kind of reminds me of the Final Four in the college basketball tournament that we just enjoyed this past weekend. If you can afford it, I'm requesting that you sign up for a $1 minimum contribution per month. You could consider it sort of like a magazine subscription. It'll cost a total of $12 per year. If you can do that, I would really appreciate it. And keep in mind, you can change your Patreon pledge or leave Patreon altogether anytime you want to. To sign up for Patreon, go to the homepage, spacerockethistory.com, and click on the Patreon link. If you are outside the U.S. or just prefer to make a one-time donation, go to the homepage and click on the orange donate button on the top right side of the page. Please support the podcast if you are able. Our total donors for 2016 have reached 89, with a goal of reaching 250 by the end of the year. To stay updated on the podcast, including previews of the next week's episode, please follow me on Twitter and Facebook. The links are on the homepage. And I want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. Feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media. And thanks to those who have already done so, like my retweeters, Jet City Star, 1202 Alarm, Andy Cox, Bird at Home, Buddy P. Murphy, Drupo Puppies, E.G. Robert, Futurama King, Gifford A.B., Glenn Trudgett, Jacob Hahn, James 2904, Gaddafi 1202, M. Lunyon, Mike Lima, Rapid Mustang, Skibby, Space Alien 39, Stephen Lebowski, Stiggy, This is Alex Boyd, Tomasino 1202, Warren Foxley, Imp Law Jack, First Aerospace, Ray L. Riv, Lanyard 73, David Benez IV, Duke of Oil 60, and CMWD website. Thank you so much for those retweets. I really appreciate it. If I missed anyone, I'll get to you next week. Okay, this is the end of the content for this episode. I had a few off-topic thoughts. If you're not interested, please feel free to switch to the next podcast now. Thanks for sticking around, folks. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Next week, we will hopefully finish with Apollo 7, and then we will move on to Soyuz 3. The Russians haven't quit yet. In other podcast news, we had close to a record number of downloads in March. We did have 5 episodes, so usually those months that we have 5 episodes on are higher. And it's good to get that many downloads, and I appreciate that. For those interested, I can present some statistics for March. These are the top 10 countries with the most downloads. Number 1 is the U.S. Number 2, the U.K. is back in second place, with Germany falling to third place in a very close race. Number 4, Australia. Number 5, Canada. 6, Spain has returned to the top 10 at the 6th position. Netherlands dropped to 7th. Sweden moves up one place to 8th. Ireland, a newcomer to the top 10, comes in at 9th place. And Italy comes in at number 10. In personal news, I am still on the road making my way west. Last week we left New Orleans and we had a really good time there seeing all the sights. But when we had to leave, there was a major downpour of rain. The streets were flooding. And I was pulling my little camper behind the truck. And let me tell you, we hit some spots on the road that had to be a foot deep in water. At some point there, I felt like I was losing traction. That was a little nerve-wracking. But I would say we got out of New Orleans just in time. Anyway, we still had a good time. This week, believe it or not, I got to go to the Johnson Space Center, and it was fantastic. I loved it, and my wife liked it pretty good, and that ain't so bad. The best part was seeing the historical mission control from the gallery. It was awesome, sitting in the gallery, looking through the glass at mission control, where all the Gemini, Apollo, and some shuttle missions were controlled. They had all the stations labeled. I took some pictures, but as you know, I've been struggling to find Wi-Fi, so I may wait till I get back home to post those pictures, because it's tough getting Wi-Fi out here. But thanks for understanding my slow response to the tweets and the Facebook and etc. like that. It's a Wi-Fi issue. That's the only problem. Okay, I'm going to close out now, and I hope to have episode 157 ready by next Thursday. So long for now.